Irreverent. Entertaining. Cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
He says what he wants, ain't holding nothing back, back. Got the recipe for life, and he's inspiring. He's not scared of any topic, from textile to gossip. Listen and to hear what Max is to share. LA Talk Radio, this is Max and Friends.
Yes, LA Talk Radio. This is Max and Friends. I'm your host, Max Tucci. Welcome back to another Sunday night edition of Max and Friends. Now, why does everyone keep saying, why do you keep saying Sunday night edition? Because we have a replay here on Mondays. So I want you to know that you're checking in on Sunday night to the live portion. But if you feel like you want to get all the archives, go to latalkradio.com/Max. There's like 7 years of shows there that you can click, enjoy, sit back, and take life to the max. How was your week, everybody? Are you living the life you want? I am, and I've got to tell you, I had a bout this weekend, over the week too, with T-Mobile. So tweet me at Max Tucci and let me know your T-Mobile woes, because I want to hear them. Not to call them out, but just to have them provide the customer service that T-Mobile clients are used to. You know, like, there's a lot of phone providers out there. And we just want, you know, if we're paying for bills and things, I get you people because you're tweeting me. We're paying our bills and we don't feel that we're getting the service that we're entitled to. Are we really entitled to it? If we pay for it, I guess so. But that's not even why we're here tonight, because we're here to enjoy life. But, you know, sometimes there's a curveball, but that's okay, because those are the moments where we have to be still and know and just exhale and remember that we got to live in the moment. So, the life you live today will set the stage for the kind of life you ultimately would like to have. Is that true? If you're not living your ideal life, do something about it. Don't blame anyone else. Don't make excuses. Just do something about it. Do it now. Don't get to the end of your life and say, what if? Have you been in that place, people, where you're like, what if? What if? Stop the what ifs and start living. Well, I've got a great guest joining me tonight in just a few moments, Dr. LaShonda Beckwith. She's got a show here, right here on LA Talk Radio, every Thursdays at 2 p.m. called Living Happy Every Day. Wouldn't that be just awesome to do that? I do it. Do you? And happiness, let me know what happiness means to you. Tweet me, at Max Tucci, and let me know. Because I've got a great tweet right now. Hey, Meganella, tell me your week was great. We've got an announcement to make. This is something that she direct messaged me on Twitter and said, will you let everybody who's tuning in, my family, know that baby number 7 is due July 12th, 2015. Congratulations to one of my favorite listeners, Meganella, who's always tweeting us. Thank you so much. Keep up the great work. Have a wonderful pregnancy. And stay tuned to tonight's show, because you're going to be able to own your life. Well, Dr. Sandra Beckwith, she is a PhD, MBA, AMA, BPS, and a friend of Max and Friends. She's an empowerment advice advocate, personal life coach, motivational speaker, and leadership expert. She knows that in order for anyone to exercise success in their personal and professional lives, there must be a fundamental change in attitude. One cannot be or think negatively and expect positive results. I believe that. You know, I remove the word negative out of life too, because I just think that when you give that word the vibration to live, that whatever follows it will follow you. So we got to be careful with our words. She is a retired executive more than 26 years with the government, but now she's joining us on Max and Friends to talk about her book, It's Your Life, Own It, on Max and Friends. Welcome, Dr. LaShonda Beckwith. How you doing, LaShonda?
I'm great. Thank you so much, Max. Thanks for having me on the show.
It's my pleasure. And you've got a show here on LA Talk Radio, so you know what we're about here. We say what we want, right?
Yeah, we do. We do. I love LA Talk Radio and the group over there, and I'm just happy to be able to be interviewed tonight.
Yeah, it's fun. It's fun when we flip the script and you get to be interviewed. But now I've got to talk to you, because you've got so much going on in your life. You love to encourage people. It's evident in all these wonderful things that you're doing and in your new book. So before we get into your book, tell us a little bit about yourself and what brought you to writing this book, having a radio show, and being really a positive role model for people in life?
Well, thanks for asking that question. You said it yourself. I wear many hats. I do a lot of different things, but all of those things accumulate into one thing, and that is really helping people to enjoy the life that they have. And what I mean by that is not settling, but recognizing that, you know, things can always be worse, and if you don't like where you're at, do something about it. And so I think everything that I do, whether it's teaching, mentoring, writing books, the radio talk show, or whatever it is that I'm doing, it all comes back to one thing, and that is to inspire people to be better.
Mm. Now, when was it in your life that you did something about it?
I a long time ago. I remember in my first book, one of the first things I talk about as an experience that kind of was a light off in my brain was when I was maybe 20 years old, and I wanted to be a manager in a particular company. And I remember everybody was getting these jobs, and that's all I wanted to be. I just wanted to be a manager, and was told over and over again, well, you can't because you don't have this, you don't have that. And so I remember thinking, and I remember how I felt. So I always felt that I would always be more than qualified for anything, and whatever I chose to do, I was going to achieve it, and nobody was going to ever make me feel little or make me feel that I couldn't accomplish what I wanted to accomplish. So I've used this term that many people may not like or understand, but there's more than one way to skin a cat. Mm-hmm. And all that means is that if somebody disappoints you and in one route that you're taking, figure out another one. And don't think that you're dumb or stupid and you can't figure it out. Just try something different. It's mm-hmm. not anybody else that's special that can do it better than you. It's just that a person tried different things and they didn't give up. And that's mm-hmm. what I encourage people to do.
I believe that fully. Don't ever give up. And you know, what's beautiful about life is that we're our own teachers, really. And no mm-hmm. one's going to live our life except for us. So we know how it works. If we tune into ourselves, we'll know the results. And there's sometimes in life where we've got to disrupt the pattern and the pathology to get us back yeah. to where we need to go. So that's your book. It's your life. Own it. No blame, mm-hmm. no excuses. Mm-hmm. Why this title and why now?
Well, that title has been in my mind for a very long time. And after I wrote the first book, When You're Happy With You, and that was, of course, reflecting on who you are. And When You're Happy With You came about as a result of me saying, hey, I finally figured it out. It's not about me being what everybody else wants me to be. Mm-hmm. It's about me looking at me and saying, hey, you're okay. And I mean it. It's not a cliche. And mm-hmm. so it's your life. Own it. It's all of these books kind of build on top of the other. It's about me talking to people in different venues, different arenas, and hearing those people that say, you know what, I'm taking the bulls by the horn and I'm going to do it. And then there's others that every time you talk to them or you listen to them talking, it's always somebody else's fault. It's always what they can't do. I don't have the education. I can't go to school. I can't find a person. I can't, you know, I can't have a relationship. I can't have this and I can't have that. And you sit and you ask them, well, why can't you? And then in what I do in my job, especially when I'm counseling and mentoring folks, when I'll offer alternatives or suggestions, then they'll say things such as, some people, that is, they'll say things such as, I come up with an excuse. So my thing is that don't sit and say, you know, you didn't have the opportunity, or don't say you couldn't do this or you couldn't accomplish this or that when you weren't even willing. So don't blame another person for not giving you a chance. Blame yourself for not taking the chance on your own. Don't blame circumstances for not providing opportunities. Just you decide that, you know what, even if I fail, I'm going to fail trying to do it. And so it is your life. My life isn't yours. I say this to people too. I can't live your dreams for you. I can provide suggestions, and I can provide you with some type of solutions, you know, options, but it's ultimately you. And so if you want your life to be different, it is your decision. That's where it came from.
How fantastic. And, you know, it's true. We all have this life path that we're on. And, you know, I find it so fascinating when other people try to live other people's lives and get caught mm-hmm. up in mm-hmm. in jealousy and envy and all these things, when sometimes it's just, I like to call it, you got to do a self-check sometimes.
Yeah, you do. Absolutely.
Right? Now,
yeah.
Does living happy mean owning your life?
Yeah, in a way. Living happy means living content. And it means this. It means that, and I want people to misunderstand and say, well, oh my God, you can't live happy all the time. And my response is, yeah, you can. But you
I was
to
just
going to
ask you, why is that people feel that they can't always live happy? Because I do. Every day.
Well, I do too. I hear you. And I can tell by your attitude and the way you talk and just your enthusiasm that you do. You embrace life and that you embrace this attitude of being positive. Something you said earlier that really struck me is when you said you have tried very hard to eliminate the word negative from your vocabulary. I am so with you there. And when you hear me use it, I'm using it to say to folks, stop it.
Right.
Because they don't understand that the words that they're speaking out into the universe are certainly things that will come back on them. Now, I know that there's people that will think that's just New Age mumbo jumbo.
No, let's go.
Here we are with that.
Let's go to church, Dr. Beck. Within the beginning was the word.
Yeah, you know, and I'm thinking, hey, so why in the world would you're right. Depending on what tradition you are, and especially, you know, I'm of a Christian tradition, but if people say such things as, you know what, well, that's just mumble jumbo. No, like you just said, Max, it is. It's a basis of the Bible. It's a basis of so many traditions, and I just don't get it, that we don't understand that we need to eliminate that kind of negativity.
I've got to tell you, I've learned throughout, you know, through this wonderful life path that I have, that really, you know, the sound and words are so important, and whether or not mm-hmm. words are, they're all created. But in really mm-hmm. the beginning, there was sound, and sound created, and the word created, and words create, sounds create. So what mm-hmm. happens is, people listening tonight, if you're just tuning in, I have Dr. Lysandra. She's great, Dr. Lysandra Beckwith, joining me on Max and Friends, Do Something About It, Living Our Life and Owning It. We're going to do something about it tonight. But the point being is that, you know, all of these words, they go out and they keep on going, and the vibration of words keep existing. So every mm-hmm. time we say something, I can't, I don't want to, forget it, never mind, none of your business, I don't want mm-hmm. to, all of these things then follow us. And when mm-hmm. I say, you know, the word negative, what it does too is negative and positive puts us into judgment, because it's almost right and wrong. So just mm-hmm. be conscious of words and the vibrations they put out, because in life it's beautiful. And what we want to do tonight is really teach you how to own your life and how to create it. So we're going to go into a life class with my great guest, Dr. Lysandra Beckwith. Tell us some steps in life that you've gone through that brought you to where you are to live your life and own it.
Well, great. One of the things I can say on my, I put a process together. It's called my 4 P's of living a successful and a happy life. Well, over the years, and I guess I can say, you know, experience teaches you so, life teaches you so much. It gives you so many experiences that you can decide to take that even and do something positive with it, or you can take it and you can say, I've had all of these challenges and I've been so this and so that. And then again, it becomes more of a negative rendition of how you see life, and it then becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy that all of the things that have happened to you will indeed defeat you. Or you can say, these are the things that have happened in my life. Okay, what do I learn from it? And for me, what I've learned over the years, and it goes back to those 5 P's of how to live a successful life, and that is, from first thing I do every day is to get up in the morning, 4 a.m., and that's my positive reflection time. That's where I'm reflecting on life. I'm meditating, prayer for me. I'm concentrating on the good things, thankful things, being thankful for things in my life. Number two, positive reinforcement. I will always edify my mind with something positive. For me, that's me reading my Bible in the morning. For others, it may be positive literature of some sort, but I'm feeding my mind with something that's going to help set my attitude, and it's not going to be. I know a lot of folks get up in the morning, they turn on the news, and they start to take in all of this negative energy. That's just something I don't do.
They absorb it.
Yes. They absorb it.
And then
absolutely.
What happens too, I believe in this so much. I'm so glad you're joining us because I believe that like attract likes. And what happens is when we wake up in the morning and the first thing we do is turn on something that's going to mumble jumble our brain and get us sidetracked, what it does is it affects our whole day. So when you start absorbing energy that doesn't belong to your mind or to your body or to your being, subconsciously we retain that, and then I guarantee you people later on the day you'll be like, did you hear on the news this morning? It sits with you. So instead of having the vibration of something pull you down sit with you all day, these four P's that we're giving you right now on Max and Friends are going to change your life. Positive reflection, positive reinforcement, and what's the third one?
Well, here we are. The other thing that a person should think about is, you know, positive nutrition and exercise.
Yes.
So, you know, the next thing that I do is I always get up after all of that's done, and I go out and I go straight to the gym. I absorb a lot of water. I go and I exercise for an hour and a half, and then I feel, too, that that has set my mind on a certain path. It's not where I'm dreading throughout the day or thinking I should have exercised or should have done this or I haven't exercised in months or different things like that. So that kind of, it's that positive nutrition, what you eat. I know there's research that supports what I'm going to say, and I've talked to folks all the time about eating processed foods and absorbing so much junk and eating a lot of, you know, sugar and white flour and rice. I know everybody's heard all of this before, but for me, it is absolutely true. So people need to be aware of nutrition and how that will either enhance your reflective abilities and enhance just your skills, you know, whether it's your critical thinking skills, whatever it is. So think about the nutrition that you're taking into your body or the types of food and the exercise. Then once I've gone through that process, so there's the reflection time, there's that meditation time, there's the reading of literature, that positive reinforcement, building and feeding your brain, and then doing the same thing for your body, because I believe that we're holistic, so all of this stuff ties together. What's happening to you physically, it happens to you mentally and emotionally, and ultimately and spiritually. And so now, I've always said that you can't encourage or empower anybody or energize anybody without having all those things. So the last two that I'm going to talk about is positive encouragement and positive energy. And so you now you're able to be that spark of inspiration, that motivation, that spark of a person where you're not being driven by circumstances, but you're able to look at situations objectively, make sound decisions, and now be able to make good decisions about your own life, too. And now you're able to take that and move it from you into the lives of other people. Earlier, you said something about why are they envious and jealous and all of that stuff? Well, all of that negative energy, all of that stuff is the result of people having low self-esteem themselves or being disappointed in their own lives. So they will start to project their inefficiencies and that lack of self-esteem onto those people that they see that are being successful, that's going somewhere in life. And so if you don't want to be that kind of person where you're obsessed with jealousy and being envious of others, then start to focus on the good qualities of yourself and ultimately focus on the good qualities of other people. But that's my five steps. So it's positive reflection, reinforcement, nutrition, and positive energy and encouragement. That's how they are.
That's beautiful. And you know what? I hope that these words are resonating with our listeners tonight. If you're just tuning in, I have a great guest joining me tonight, Dr. LaShonda Beckwith. She's got a show here on LA Talk Radio on Thursdays at 2 p.m. It's a fun show, so I encourage you to all go tune in. Living happy every day. It's possible, people, and it is possible to own your own life. You know, I totally believe that our life is big, so we have to keep reaching. And the only way we can keep reaching is by encouraging one another to really live a life of happiness. It's obtainable. And I'm not saying you're not going to have days where things are sad and not going how you perceive them to go. But just remember that where you are right now is exactly where you're supposed to be. And that's tuning in to Max and Friends on Sunday nights here on LA Talk Radio. I love you all for tuning in. Keep tweeting me at Max Tucci. Again, the list, the five P's, everyone. Positive reflection, positive reinforcement, positive nutrition, and of course, to get yourself up and motivated and going to the gym. Positive encouragement and positive energy. If you can't go to the gym, just exercise, be it right in your house. Move your body. Our bodies are made to move. Every little bone, every fiber is made to be moved and loved. And look at yourself in the mirror and tell yourself, I love you. This is my life and I'm going to own it. Doctor, we got the doctor in the house tonight. Would you join me again on Max and Friends? Because we've got a lot to talk about. And this is just a taste, but we've got to play a great recording tonight about money, guilt, and the machine. So,
okay.
Life goes on, it sure does. Now, life goes on for you, and what are you doing with your life? What's next for you?
Well, man, there's so much going on in my life. I don't know where to start. I'm right now just starting to promote the new book. It just dropped this month. It's Your Life, Own It. And so I'll be around and about promoting the book. I just got back yesterday from Israel where we were over doing some training and some teaching videos and stuff. And in May, we'll be heading to India to do some business types of projects, but I'm checking things off my bucket list. I'm chair of a business department at one of the universities here in Dallas, Texas, and we're just doing great things. I can't even begin to start to share all of the things that I'm doing, but right now my focus is on getting this book out, and I'm in the middle of writing my third one, but right now, Max, this is it.
Now, where can people get this book?
They can get this book at Amazon.com. It's online, of course, Barnes & Noble, just about any site online. Or they can go to the actual publisher site at www.authorhouse.com.
How fantastic. And how can people follow you on Twitter and such?
Well, I'd love for folks to find me at on Twitter at LaShonda1. It's just the number one, LaShonda1. And then at Facebook, I have a huge presence on there, too. I do a Thought for Today on Facebook and Twitter. And that's just look for LaShonda. No, nothing extreme on both Facebook and Twitter. I'm on Instagram. So, yeah, just follow me there. Come and friend me there. I'd love to connect with you. The other thing is I do a monthly article column in the Wordsmith Journal magazine, and it's called Positive Faith. But on Facebook and Twitter, I do a Thought for Today. It's called the TFT, and it's just a word of encouragement, and it's in-your-face kind of stuff. So don't think that it's going to be, you know, solve mansy-pansy type of stuff. It's pretty much in-your-face.
What was the thought for the day?
Yeah, what was the thought for today? Today?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm getting it for you because I do so many. I'm trying to get to it real quick. And of course, it'll take forever to get to it because I'm talking to you.
You get and I'll talk. So everyone, if you're just tuning in, Dr. LaShonda Beckwith is going to give us the thought for the day. Coming up next, we have Alan Watts. I've got to say congratulations to Meganella, baby number 7 on the way, and Sabrina Barnett. Thank you for tuning in and listening tonight. Keep tweeting me at Max Tucci and let me know what's going on in your life and how you're owning it every day. Your life is big, people. Keep reaching. Keep reaching. So what was the thought for today?
Well, I'm going to tell you. It's hard for me to tell you because my system's not pulling up. Sorry, Max.
That's okay. So give us a new thought for the day.
Well, okay. So
give us a thought. Here's what I'll give you. Give us a thought that we can go into this week retaining that will make us own our life.
Okay, well, here's one. Don't focus so much on what other people are doing, but focus on defining your own life. It's real simple. When you're focused on other people, and usually the thought for today is really only two lines, and I believe now that I'm telling you, it was about stop looking so much at what other people are doing, but look at your own life, define it. Stop judging others. And so that's the kind of thing that it's about. It's not 5 and 6 pages long, nor is it, 3 and 4 paragraphs. It's usually just a two-liner. And today's was, when we stop judging and focusing on others, trying to define them, we lose defining our own lives. So that's pretty much what today's was about.
That's the truth. And you know what? We win by stop judging,
by not judging.
We win. We are all created to be winners. We are all the head and not the tail. And people, this week, we're going to have a wonderful week. Dr. Beckwith, thank you so much for joining me. We're going to have you back on Max and Friends real soon.
Max, thanks for having me on the show. I appreciate it. And good luck to you. And
thank you. Have fun
with your guests.
I'm going to talk to you after the show in just a minute, so I'll call you in a moment. All right?
Okay.
Have a
beautiful
week, Dr. Beckwith.
You
all right,
too.
Everyone. Now's the time where we're going to talk about what I've been wanting to talk about to y'all for so long. Money, Guilt, and the Machine on Max and Friends with Alan Watts. Now, this is a recording, and I'm so grateful to have this recording because if you get something from it, great. If you don't, that's okay, too. Just live your life to the max. Next Sunday, we've got John O'Hurley joining us. Have a wonderful week because I'm going to rest my voice. As y'all can still hear, I need to rest my voice. So this is the point of the show where if you got kids in the room, get out because it might get a little heavy. All right? I love you all for listening. Take life to the max. Good night and good karma. But up next is Alan Watts, Money, Guilt, and the Machine. Good night, y'all. Max Tucci.
LA Talk Radio, this is Max and Friends.
So this goes very deep into us. It goes deep, deep, deep into a problem we have about guilt. I wonder often if there's any relationship between guilt and gold. That the love of money is the root of evil. It's a very true saying. Because you see, I was saying yesterday that the difference between having a job and having a vocation is that a job is some unpleasant work you do in order to make money, with the sole purpose of making money. And there are plenty of jobs because there is still a certain amount of dirty work that nobody wants to do and that therefore they will pay someone to do it. There is essentially less and less of that kind of work because of mechanization. But if you do a job with the sole purpose of making money, you are absurd. Because if money becomes the goal, and it does when you work that way, you begin increasingly to confuse it with happiness or with pleasure. Yes, one can kick a whole handful of crisp dollar bills and practically water your mouth over them. But this is this kind of a person who is confused like a Pavlov dog who salivates on the wrong bell. It goes back, you see, to the ancient guilt that if you don't work, you have no right to eat. That if there are others in the world who don't have enough to eat, you shouldn't enjoy your dinner, even though you have no possible means of conveying the food to them. And while it is true that we are all one human family, and that every individual involves every other individual, while it is true, therefore, we should do something about changing the situation, the one way of not doing anything about a situation is feeling guilty about it. Because when people feel guilty about a situation, they most usually, instead of doing something practical to change it, they resort to all sorts of symbolic methods of expiation. They go to confession. They see an analyst. They do all kinds of things which will be ways of actually not doing anything about the problem, but feeling all right about it instead. And guilt invariably produces that sort of reaction. It is a destructive emotion. Instead, we need to have a different attitude to our mistakes and to our misdeeds. Walt Whitman always admired animals because they do not lie awake at night and weep for their sins. Our animals are practical, in the real sense, as are children who haven't been taught this extraordinary hang-up of guilt. Because if you have done something wrong, or you have made a mistake, and somebody makes you ashamed of it and guilty, you run around licking the sores of your wounded ego, because you feel your pride has been hurt. The first thing to understand is that it is not a serious failing in a human being to make mistakes. Everybody has to make mistakes. There is no way out of it. You can't learn anything unless you make mistakes. We find, for example, in Japan, the Japanese have a terrible hang-up about making mistakes. They therefore never have the courage to practice their English properly. They've had 7 years of English in school, most of it very, very badly taught, and it's irrelevant English. They learn all about Shakespeare and Dickens and Thackeray and Thomas Hardy and so on, and therefore they can't carry on an everyday conversation. It's like the way the English study French. All about pens of gardener's ants and things like that. But they are ashamed to try out their English unless drunk. So if you want to get into conversation with the Japanese in English, you have to go to bars. And then they say university students and so on there will loosen up and talk. Because they no longer have the inhibition, the shame of saying the wrong thing. So likewise, I know a very great anthropologist who was taught music, playing the piano, in the same way I was. When I was taught music, the school mom who taught me used to put an India rubber, an eraser it's called in this country, on the top of each hand, so that I would have my hands in good posture. And every time I'd play a wrong note, she'd hit my fingers with a pencil. And this great anthropologist had had a similar sort of musical education. And when confronted with a piano in the presence of an absolutely marvelous teacher in San Francisco, she said she was amazed. He was completely incapable of reading notes. He blocked at everything. So another great teacher of the piano I knew said simply, "You must not be afraid of playing wrong notes. Forget it. Play it wrong. And then eventually go over it again and you'll eventually get it right. But you must not block. Always keep the same rhythm going. even if you have to slow it down, but keep the proportionate rhythm of one note to another. And if it's the wrong note, play the wrong note, as long as you play something in the right rhythm. So, you know, this is a way of taking away people's blockage, people's guilt and shame about making mistakes. So you absolutely, freedom means, basically, the freedom to make mistakes. The freedom to be a damn fool. And then not to recriminate with yourself when you do finally realize that it was a mistake, but simply don't do it again. Or at least do it less often. So, you know, this is the puzzle. When you go to confession in the Catholic Church, which is an enormous method of inculcating a sense of guilt, very subtle. One says, of course, that Catholics are, on the whole, less guilty than Protestants. They're more relaxed. And there's some truth in that, but only some. Protestants, of course, have chronic guilt. And you can work this out by a very simple little formula, that when the Protestants in England abandoned what is called auricular confession to a priest, they inserted in their prayer book a general confession in which the congregation all made its confession together. Now, what does a Catholic say when he makes his confession? The formula is, I confess to God Almighty, to Blessed Mary, Ever Virgin, Blessed John the Baptist, the Holy Apostles, Peter and Paul, and all the saints, that I have sinned exceedingly in thought, word, and deed, by my fault, by my own fault, by my own most grievous fault. Wherefore I beg Blessed Mary, etc., and you, Father, to pray for me to the Lord our God. And the priest says, Almighty God, have mercy upon you, forgive you your sins, and bring you to everlasting life. By the authority of our Lord Jesus Christ committed unto me, I absolve thee from all thy sins in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Period. Now, instead of that, what they had to introduce into the Anglican formulary was, instead of this very simple confession of sins and before the whole company of heaven, an absolute grovel, wherein they say that they have sinned so horribly and that the remembrance of these sins is grievous unto us, the burden of them is intolerable, have mercy upon us, most merciful Father. And all this cringing and crying, breast beating and wallowing in guilt. And then the priest, instead of saying a simple formula of absolution, quotes all kind of scriptural texts to prove from the Bible that those who do truly and earnestly repent will be forgiven by God. Because they're very uncertain about it, therefore they have to quote all the authorities. And this absolutely groveling form of confession replaces the old one, because they were a little bit scared about abandoning direct confession of sins to the priest. But now the going back to the Catholic problem about guilt, you say, when you have confessed after saying this formula about to all the saints, you confess the specific sins you've committed. And, you know, I stole something, committed adultery 3 times, and so on, whatever it was. And then you say at the end, for these and all my sins which I cannot now remember. I firmly purpose amendment, and humbly ask pardon of God, and of you, Father, absolution. Now, I firmly purpose amendment. That is where the fly in the ointment consists. Because the doctrine is that you have made a true confession if at the same time you have a sincere intention of acting differently in the future. Now, no sensitive Catholic can say that without having grave doubts as to whether actually he isn't going to do some of these things again. So if you're a workaday Catholic, like a Mexican peasant or something like that, you know that the confession is just a safety valve. You're going to go on living just as lackadaisically as ever, but you go to church every so often and you get rid of the guilt and the evil. It's like going to the bathroom. But when you get thoughtful about these things and you wonder whether you do really mean what you say, whether your motive is pure and your intention is right, you get into a frightful hang-up. And one of the reasons that our technology is impeded and prevented from feeding the world properly is the failure of one of our networks. It's an information network, and it's called money, about which we have the most unbelievable superstitions and psychological blocks, which have been gone into at some length by Freud, who equates our valuation of money with our attitude to excrement, and a very complicated lot of complexes grow up around that. But money and our psychological attitude to money is a major obstacle to a proper development of technology, enabling it to do what it is supposed to do, that is, to save labor and to produce goods, services, and so on adequately. So I must introduce this with a story which is entirely legendary. Indeed, quite apocryphal. The great banks of the world, at one time, got absolutely sick of the expense and security measures involved in shipping consignments of gold from one bank to another. And so they decided that all the chief banks of the world would open offices on a certain island in the South Pacific, which was balmy and comfortable, and there they would store all the gold in the world. And they put it in great subterranean vaults reached by deep elevator shafts. And then all they had to do when one bank or one country owed gold to another was to trundle it across the street. And this was very efficient. And it went on beautifully for 5 or 6 years. And then the presidents of the world banks got together and said, let's have a convention out on this island and take our wives and families. So about 7 years from the date of opening, all those presidents and their wives and families went out to this Pacific island, and they inspected the books, and everything was beautifully in order. Then the children said, oh, Daddy, can't we see the gold? They said, of course you may see the gold. And they said to the managers, let's take our children down to the vaults and show them the gold. And the managers said, well, it's a little bit inconvenient at this time, and perhaps the children would not really be very interested. After all, it's just only old plain gold. And the president said, oh, no, come now. They'd be thrilled. Let's go down and see. And there was further humming and hawing and delays. And finally it came out that a few years before, there had been a catastrophic subterranean earthquake. And all the vaults had been swallowed up and all the gold had disappeared. But so far as the bookkeeping was concerned, everything was in perfect order. What this means then is that money is nothing but bookkeeping. It is figures. It is a way of measuring what you owe the community and what the community owes you. It is, of course, as you all know, a substitute for barter. If you worked on a farm and the farmer paid you in terms of ears of corn, onions, cabbages, and other vegetables, and yet you wanted a pot and pan of some kind, and you took a few vegetables over to the man who so made pots and pans, and you swapped. Some people used cowrie shells to stand for money so that you wouldn't have to barter and carry around all these inconvenient loads of goods. And then, of course, gold was used because gold was rare and because gold was supposed to have a constant value. You might ponder the question, when a banker buys gold, with what does he pay for it? The answer is a mystery called credit. Credit is bookkeeping. And as the economy of the Western world developed, it was found that there was not enough gold around, if it were to remain constant in value, to exchange goods and services. You could, of course, have changed the picture by putting down the price of goods and services to keep pace with the amount of gold in circulation. But nobody will ever put down the price. There's something in our psychology whereby prices always tend to go up. But at the same time, therefore, because the amount of gold in the world did not provide an adequate channel for the circulation of goods and services, all great industrial nations went heavily into debt. They created a thing called the national debt, which year by year gets bigger and bigger and bigger, to the horror and consternation of old-fashioned Republicans who pay their bills. But the reason for the increase of the national debt is extremely obvious. It is that with an expanding gross national product, there needs to be more and more money, that is to say, tokens of exchange, in order to circulate the amount of goods produced, which is ever increasing. Now, I'm not an economist, and I can refer you to the work of those who really are. But any fool can see certain extremely fundamental principles about this whole situation. And I'm speaking of the thought today of a man called Robert Theobald, who sort of ties in with the general picture of people like McLuhan and Buckminster Fuller, in having very far-out thoughts and very adventurous thoughts about what we should do about money. But he is in the following of a man like Frederick Soddy, who was a Nobel Prize chemist, who was one of the first people to think really freshly about economics, or people like Silvio Gesell in Austria and Major Douglas in England. He's in that following. And the proposition that he puts forward is very simple, that money is a circulation of information and in itself has no value. Gold, of course, has some value. It has some value for an industry and some value for dentistry and some value for jewelry. But as a means of exchanging the goods and services of the world, it is as primitive as post horses for carrying the mail. We must recognize then that money is a pure abstraction. I was on a television show a little while ago with Ted Sorensen and Raymond Moley. And they were having a long, long discussion, which sounded like something that goes on in a smoke-filled back room of party bosses, where they were talking about the prospects for the Republican Democratic parties in 1968. And then they got onto the question of automation and the problems of unemployment that it was making and the difficulties of transferring workers from this to that when they were only trained for this. Finally, I said, the trouble with you gentlemen is you still think money is real. And they looked at me and sort of said, oh, someone who doesn't think money is real, because everybody knows money is money and it's very important. But it just isn't real at all, because it has the same relationship to real wealth, that is to say, to actual goods and services, that words have to meaning, that words have to the physical world. And as words are not the physical world, money is not wealth. It only is an accounting of available energy, economic energy. Now, what happens then when you introduce technology into production? You produce enormous quantities of goods by technological methods. But at the same time, you put people out of work. You can say, oh, but it always creates more jobs. There will always be more jobs, yes. But they will be, lots of them will be futile jobs. They will be jobs making every kind of frippery and unnecessary contraption. And one will also at the same time have to beguile the public into feeling that they need and want these completely unnecessary things that aren't even beautiful. And therefore an enormous amount of nonsense employment and busy work, bureaucratic and otherwise, it has to be created in order to keep people working. Because we believe, as good Protestants, that the devil finds work for idle hands to do. But the basic principle of the whole thing has been completely overlooked. That the purpose of the machine is to make drudgery unnecessary. And if we don't allow it to achieve its purpose, we live in a constant state of self-frustration. So then, if a given manufacturer automates his plant and dismisses his labor force, and they have to operate on a very much diminished income, say some sort of dole, the manufacturer suddenly finds that the public does not have the wherewithal to buy his products. And therefore he has invested in this expensive automotive machinery to no purpose. And therefore, obviously, the public has to be provided with the means of purchasing what the machines produce. But people say, that's not fair. Where's the money going to come from? Who's going to pay for it? The answer is the machine. The machine pays for it. Because the machine works for the manufacturer and for the community. This is not saying, you see, that this is not the statist communist idea that you expropriate the manufacturer and say you can't own and run this factory anymore, it is owned by the government. It is only saying that the government or the people have to be responsible for issuing to themselves sufficient credit to circulate the goods they are producing and have to balance the measuring standard of money with the gross national product. That means that taxation is obsolete, completely obsolete. It ought to go the other way. Theobald points out that every individual should be assured of a minimum income. Now you see, that absolutely horrifies most people. Say, all these wastrels, these people who are out of a job because they're really lazy, see, given them money? Yeah. Because otherwise the machines can't work. They come to a blockage. This was the situation of the Great Depression, when here we were still, in a material sense, a very rich country, with plenty of fields and farms and mines and factories, everything going. But suddenly, because of a psychological hang-up, because of a mysterious mumbo-jumbo about the economy, about the banking, we were all miserable and poor, starving in the midst of plenty, just because of a psychological hang-up. And that hang-up is that money is real, and that people ought to suffer in order to get it. But the whole point of the machine is to relieve you of that suffering. It is an ingenuity. You see, we are psychologically back in the 17th century and technically in the 20th. And here comes the problem. So, what we have to find out how to do is to change the psychological attitude to money and to wealth, and furthermore to pleasure, and furthermore to the nature of work. And this is a formidable problem. It requires the best brains in public relations, in propaganda, in all that kind of thing, in all the media, television, radio, newspapers, everything, to try to get across a message to the vast general public about what money is. You see, the difficulty is this. When the public suspects that the money that is being issued, the dollar bills being issued by the government, are only paper and stand only for paper, they start putting up prices. And so you get an inflationary situation where the more paper money there is, the higher and higher and higher the prices go. Which is a very stupid psychological maneuver. And people have to be persuaded. The least effective way of persuading people is passing laws, but they have to be persuaded somehow not to put up the prices, but to play fair with each other and keep some sort of standard correspondence between how much is produced and how much credit is issued.